Good morning, everybody. We are back to our study of the Life Divine, chapter on the divine and the undivine. And I believe in the PDF version, we are on page 421. Am I right?
Yes, that's what I have as well.
Right. And I think the paragraph we will start with begins, "But even when we thus regard the universe." And as we discussed last time, in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo is taking account for our experience of what we can call the undivine elements, first from the viewpoint of even our intuition of what could be the divine. We set it up as something which must be ultimately good, an absolute good, as well as something which is all existence without a second, in other words, which cannot have a duality within it that escapes from either its purview, its omniscience, its knowledge, or its power, its omniscience. And yet, we experience a world in which things are not good in that sense. That is, that we experience suffering. We experience death, which is a cessation of life, subjection to disappearance of being. And we experience various other forms of indignity, which can be classified as evil, not even as ignorance. A lack of the ability to deal with the impacts of life, and a sense as if we have been thrown into a world of determinisms from which or over which we have little control. So out of this condition, it is easy to deny the existence of the divine, which we can, you know, think of as something which does not meet or fulfill our highest idealisms and aspirations.
I think there's a lot of noise. Somebody has the phone muted.
Somebody has their phone.
Likely. Oh. Okay, it's better now.
Yeah, sorry, I just joined and
So this is the condition from which we have to start, and Sri Aurobindo is giving account of this. So on the one hand, we can just deny the existence of the divine. On the other hand, we can take a stand where we somehow assert some kind of separation from the divine, which we either posit in terms of an incomprehensible maya, a power of projection, which nevertheless does not produce meaning, that idea of meaning, which is again another intuition that we carry with us, that there is significance to the cosmos and to our experience, that somehow there is some kind of an idea behind everything that explains our existence, maybe just an epiphenomenon. This is the standpoint that some schools take, schools which are called Mayavadin. In other words, they believe that there exists our experience, but it is a meaningless experience. And it is given to us to escape from this experience, that we can actually encounter and identify with that good, all good, infinite, omnipotent being, which has, for no reason, because it is beyond reason, cast a certain kind of incomprehensible chaos as the condition of its own workings in the cosmos in which we find ourselves. But Sri Aurobindo looks at this problem from two sides. And so far, we have been made privy to one of these two sides, which is really the side which we can call the cosmic side. So from that cosmic viewpoint, he has already pointed out, and that's why in this chapter comes where it does, so that he can draw on the mechanism of the cosmic idea that he has already introduced to explain this experience from the universal or cosmic viewpoint. And that's what we have been looking at so far. From that viewpoint, we can see that there is a certain idea where the divine or the all-conscious being has created a form of self-perception which is graded and phased, and which is graded and phased, in other words, there is a variation which is subject to a systematic form. So this systematic form or systemic form of self-variation of consciousness in space is what we experience as the gradation of consciousness. And the same kind of systematic form of a self-variation in terms of time is what we experience as a phased self-experience or an evolutionary self-experience. And this kind of self-perception and self-exploration is also accompanied by instantiation. In other words, into this self-variation of consciousness, the infinite potential of the divine enters at each of these rungs of the emergent properties of consciousness and explores itself through a variety of combinations, infinite combinations, which becomes the instances through which these self-varying levels of consciousness are manifest. We are part of this instantiation. And the entirety of the divine is present in each of its self-varied rungs of consciousness and each of its instances of self-expression and self-exploration. So from the divine point of view, the limitation of consciousness experienced at each rung is a freely self-limited consciousness. The entirety of the divine is present in each of these self-limited ranges or rungs of consciousness in a latent form. It has done this by a form of self-concentration. So, putting the rest of it, as it were, behind, just as we do with our own memory, it deploys only a certain range of its own consciousness and makes that the ground of its self-exploration through instances and their play. Therefore, to the divine, to the cosmic consciousness of the divine. At every level, there is only a freely chosen field of its self-manifestation. And there is no real experience of suffering as such. There is the experience of something held back and something allowed to encounter the totality of the shocks of the world and respond in whatever measure it can within the range of consciousness given to it. But it is all a play of delight, and the all delight is experiencing whatever is experienced from the cosmic point of view. There is also the question of result. In other words, what kind of success or failure, in terms of the will of these instances, we can talk about a whole gradation of free will, is experienced. And once we think about that, then we start coming into sort of positing a sense of meaning at the level of the instance. There is a sense of meaning at the level of the cosmos, if we talk about an idea of self-variation and self-prospection. But at the level of the instance, at the level of the individual, there can only be meaning if the individual in some way is involved in that meaning. And that is seen by Sri Aurobindo in terms of the evolution of the individual, the individuation, you may say, that is occurring at every one of these rungs. The person who has entered into this cosmos through a process of self-sacrifice is reconstituting itself as individual. So, on the one hand, as we are right now in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo is explaining the cosmos to us, or explaining the cosmic consciousness to us. Why it is we experience suffering? Because of the self-limitation of the divine, but also because of the mask that is put on by the instance that makes it experience this self-limitation as an individual condition. So that the individual feels separated from the rest, cannot experience that which is held behind as the buffer and the field of possibility out of which this self experiences being freely chosen by its own deepest reality. But having said that, we could justify that condition, which is what I started with saying. We could justify the cosmic condition, and we could even say that the cosmic condition is something which is evolving, that at the highest rungs of this entire field of self-varied consciousness, there is the knowledge of the One at play with itself or in itself. But that would completely devalue the question of the individual aspiration. Why is it that there is significance, or what is the significance of the individual? And this is where Sri Aurobindo starts, in this very complex way of looking at things, suddenly flipping the kaleidoscope, as it were, turning it from the cosmos to the individual, and saying there is value in that. that if we are dissatisfied, as he has pointed out from the very first chapter, what really characterizes the human is his divine discontent. And in this value given to the individual, in a sense, he is affirming the entire tradition and history of human aspiration. The human being and the will of the human to exceed its limitations, that something in us rejects the conditions of the cosmos which express anything undivine. And it is there because we are the agents of that evolution. The cosmic evolution is not taking place automatically. It is taking place, in fact, by the power of the individual. Even in the atom, at every level, and this is what gives value to the idea of the avatar and the vibhuti, that indeed it is the person whose self-expression is pushing the evolution forward. If there is a jump from one state of bondage to a greater state of freedom, it is accomplished by the evolution of the person, of the Purusha. So I think this is where we are at this point, and the last paragraph we read, I read the last line, because we'll see how he turns the equation, moving from the cosmos to the individual, right there in that, preparing us for this new way of looking at things. So he says, at every turn, it is the divine reality which we discover behind that which we are yet compelled by the nature of the superficial consciousness in which we dwell to call undivine. And in a sense, are right in using that appellation, for these appearances are a veil over the divine perfection, a veil necessary for the present, but not at all the true and complete figure. So even from the cosmic point of view, this is a denial of the truth of things in terms of the self-representation of the divine. And so our feeling that it is undivine is a justified intuition, which is not only right for ourselves, but also for the cosmos. We serve the cosmic purpose in feeling that. This is how he ends that paragraph. So, if anybody would like to comment, or if there's any questions, we can take it up, discuss it, and then continue with this next paragraph.
Devashish, it's Joanna. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, absolutely.
In the discussion where he's talking about the divine discontent in the human, I find that there's something missing, and maybe it's just in another place and I didn't find it. But if there is truly integral consciousness and the entire creation or the entire absolute has intelligence and participates in this evolution, I'm not sure how you could say that the human is the only one who has divine discontent, or that the human is responsible for the movement of evolution. It seems to me that's a fallacy. Can you just talk a little about that?
Yeah, sure, Joanna. And you're completely right. I mean, he's not actually claiming that the human has responsibility for pushing the evolution. That would be, as we say, anthropocentric. He is saying that's the point I was making. From the atom up, from every level, this is going on. There is consciousness that's why the whole, even the idea of the avatar in the Indian conception starts from the animal. But that's only a manner of speaking, because we could start from the atom, you know. So it isn't that the human is the origin of this evolution of the person, but certain structures of consciousness emerge at the human level, which give it greater agency in being able to participate more completely in the turn, in that turning. Its potency has come to a certain critical point, in other words. It can do something with its consciousness because of the, you know, power within the nature that can house a greater sort of self-constitution of the Purusha.
Well, it seems to me that we're aware of that because we are human and we can relate to what the capabilities of the human are. But we might not be aware of what some structures of consciousness that come from other species or other structures in the universe, and what their effects are. I mean, we really are limited in what we can receive.
Yeah, but that's also an appearance. We are limited in what we can achieve, yes. But that self-limitation, again, of the range of the human.
I said not what we can achieve. I said limited in appearance of what we can receive.
Receive, yeah. The limited in appearance of what we can receive, quite true. But what he's saying is essentially, again, there isn't any kind of the notion that we cannot identify with the animal completely is also an appearance. It seems as if we can't, but we can. And the idea is that in that extension of consciousness, there is what he's positing over here, we can take from a certain point to be mental only, that there is a systematic, because there's an idea behind it, that there is a systematic gradation of consciousness and emergent properties, etc. And so we can radicalize the relativity and say, well, human beings are only a certain range and we can never know anything that goes on in the animal. But that's not really true. What he's saying essentially over here is that these emergent properties of consciousness are something which at a certain level with experience we can actually experience. And in that way we can know what it is that each one of these rungs is capable of expressing in terms of the structures of consciousness there. See? So this idea that, you know, kind of, you know, dogs can become supermen or super dogs, you know, is also there in a number of cultures. You have, I mean, in India itself, this, the idea of the animal that is divine is quite prevalent, as well as the idea that the hybrid, animal-human hybrid, is a more appropriate figure for the divine than just an anthropocentric divine. All these kinds of ideas do exist, and there are properties there, because these are kind of like a zoanthropic hybrid is something that definitely outside the range of whatever has been expressed. But the point that is being made over here, basically, again, and that he doesn't make it clear over here, is that the evolution of the Purusha through all this is also acquiring new characteristics. That's why, in a sense, the sense of personhood, of being an individual, the self, the reflexivity of the individual, I am an individual, that becomes available at the level of rationality, deployed in the nature of the human, is much more full-blown than the same sense of personhood at the animal level. Now we can say we are just surmising this. Animals are as much persons as humans are. But then, if we do that, then we are basically saying that we are limited to our intelligence, and everything becomes a relative play of just all, everything is equally true. What he's saying over here is that no, there is an evolution of the Purusha that is going on. And that personhood is, in some sense, increasing its structures of self-awareness. And at the human, this is what actually allows, and the principal difference between, let's say, the Judaic tradition or the Abrahamic tradition, which says that man is created in the image of God, and, say, the Upanishadic tradition, which kind of says something very similar, but sort of qualifies it by saying what we may say, man is potentially made in the image of God, in the sense that there are structures that are available to us that can be pushed, whose boundaries can be pushed. And this is exactly how Sri Aurobindo is defining the human as a transitional being. You know, that self-definition of the human is not fixed. While the ranges within which the self-definition of other beings, species exist, is much more fixed. This is basically how he's looking upon, looking at it.
Okay. I guess where, what I think of in terms of this that maybe is a little bit different from what Sri Aurobindo is saying, and maybe not, I'm not sure, is a tradition in the Native American culture where they say that there used to be something called old language in which people could speak with animals, animals could speak with people, that somehow died out. And I guess it's more of a, of a sense of not recognizing how to do the partnerships, or the relationships aren't there. I don't know, because it still seems like there's a missing piece here. To even with all that said, except that we were talking about the ability of being able to intuit the characteristics and the structures of animals, but I think that there's still a mystery there that we haven't, that requires space, room.
Yeah, possibly. I think basically, you know, he's talking about becoming universal. If one is to become truly cosmic, that would include that experience. I mean, certainly, you know, there are many levels of these experiences. One is a knowledge in essence. Another is knowledge in power. There are different powers of knowledge, you may say. And knowledge of communication, these are different powers of knowledge, and in becoming cosmic, they are all involved. I mean, communicating with animals is certainly something which the extension of consciousness is supposed to bring us. We can find in the record of yoga that he's communicating with ants, with butterflies all the time. So, you know, I don't think that that is something which is kind of being denied over here. What you're talking about regarding the animal language, that something very interesting, and I think Gebser is also a very good source in thinking about these things. The earliest, I mean, it's not just Native American, but if you look at the early expressions of kind of, say, Aboriginal art, or going into the early Neolithic phases, we find that this consciousness of the animal is very, very close to us. We started off as people who shared land with the animals, and yet we dominated them. I mean, the whole notion, it's basically a kind of a, in a way, a certain type of a, it can be read as a certain kind of a guilt obviation to kill the animal and then put on the characteristics of the animal, wear the animal's horns or clothes or whatever, and therefore become animal, as it were, to assimilate the animal. It also does betoken a certain level of much deeper intimacy and exchange with the animal, and that has happened. And you see, as we have urbanized, our distance from the animal has increased, and we find that in certain societies it has completely ruptured, and therefore you come to a situation where it becomes almost as if we completely deny any possibility of identity with the animal. But this is not necessary, and this has not been the case everywhere. I wouldn't say, for example, that in general, kind of people in South Asia today, in India, for example, today, have a much greater sense of communication with animals than others. But certainly there is a much more comfortable living with the animal. And this has happened because even when we urbanized, we find that these rituals of relating and communicating with animals and assimilating the animal, becoming animal, have continued. See? So, in a sense, that capacity has only been suppressed. It isn't something that doesn't exist, and it's not that we lost it, permanently. But in the expansion of consciousness, in becoming cosmic, it is a certain aspect that has to return. He's not necessarily giving explicit attention to it over here, but it is implied.
The Native American way of living, it was not a dominance over nature. It was a participation with nature, at least in some of the native cultures. So
I understand that. It was the same with almost every culture. But also there was some domination involved, because we are more intelligent than the animal. We are using certain faculties that the animal does not have. And, however primitive we are using those faculties. The animal can't do to us what we can do to the animal.
So would you say it's something that's actually been lost with the development of the mind and with processes like what Sri Aurobindo follows in the record of the yoga, it comes back into more conscious use?
Yeah, I think the growth of consciousness, and it actually, you see, it's such a complex and vast thing to becoming cosmic. See, one can try to become cosmic piecemeal. That is, one can choose one particular area and say, I'd like to do this, I'd like to kind of become cosmic at the level of communicating with animals. But that is only one aspect of it. And the point he's making is that the higher one goes in the rungs of our consciousness, it's like finding the one key that can turn all the locks. And so the idea is that the cosmic consciousness is already something which communicates at all these levels. And the human range of consciousness is limited. And we have suppressed or kind of cut out certain types of structures. But the human consciousness is transitional as well. We can include all these structures of consciousness. They are potentially available to us. And that is essentially the growth of consciousness yields a variety of these kinds of identities that are not going to happen in the same way for everybody. But at the same time, they gradually develop, and one can find that there is kind of levels of understanding that are shut to us now that start opening up.
Thank you. Margaret, would you like to start reading?
Yes. But even when we thus regard the universe, we cannot and ought not to dismiss as entirely and radically false and unreal the values that are given to it by our own limited human consciousness. For grief, pain, suffering, error, falsehood, ignorance, weakness, wickedness, incapacity, non-doing of what should be done, and wrongdoing, deviation of will and denial of will, egoism, limitation, division from other beings with whom we should be one, all that makes up the effective figure of what we call evil are facts of the world consciousness, not fictions and unrealities. Although they are facts whose complete sense or true value is not that which we assign to them in our ignorance, still, our sense of them is part of a true sense. Our values of them are necessary to their complete values. One side of the truth of these things we discover when we get into a deeper and larger consciousness. For we find then that there is a cosmic and individual utility in what presents itself to us as adverse and evil. For without experience of pain, we would not get all the infinite value of the divine delight of which pain is in travail. All ignorance is a penumbra which environs an orb of knowledge. Every error is significant of the possibility and the effort of a discovery of truth. Every weakness and failure is a first sounding of gulfs of power and potentiality. All division is intended to enrich by an experience of various sweetness of unification, the joy of realized unity. All this imperfection is to us evil, but all evil is in travail of the eternal good. For all is an imperfection, which is the first condition in the law of life evolving out of inconscience, of a greater perfection in the manifesting of the hidden divinity. But at the same time, our present feeling of this evil and imperfection, the revolt of our consciousness against them, is also a necessary valuation. For if we have first to face and endure them, the ultimate command on us is to reject, to overcome, to transform the life and the nature. It is for that end that their insistence is not allowed to slacken The soul must learn the results to the ignorance, must begin to feel their reactions as a spur to its endeavor of mastery and conquest, and finally, to a greater endeavor of transformation and transcendence. It is possible, when we live inwardly in the depths, to arrive at a state of vast inner equality and peace, which is untouched by the reactions of the outer nature. And that is a great but incomplete liberation. For the outer nature, too, has a right to deliverance. But even if our personal deliverance is complete, still there is the suffering of others, the world travail, which the great of soul cannot regard with indifference. There is a unity with all beings, which something within us feels, and the deliverance of others must be felt as intimate to its own deliverance.
So here's where we see him turning, towards the individual and the external conditions and validating them in terms of the evolution. And so this is, again, a very characteristic turn in terms of Sri Aurobindo's position or place in philosophy. If we look at the Indian tradition, for example, this has been underplayed tremendously. There isn't much value given to the individual as such. It is a play of the divine or of the gods, and the individual is a devotee who is privy to the play of the gods, but the place of the individual can, even if there is an expansion of capacities through yoga, is generally seen as one which exists to accept the conditions of the cosmos or to escape from them. But even escape is a form of acceptance. In other words, there is nothing we can do about it. You see. But rather, the traditions that have switch to the other side, which are the traditions that have given, validated and given value to the human effort to perfect the world. It is as if, seen by many religions as a hubris, as, the kind of, the almost the necessary condition or cause of punishment. The Titans do things like that in the Greek traditions, for example, choose to steal fire from the gods to fuel the unhappiness of human condition. He sees as, in fact, God's own steps into the point of fullness or completion. And so, as he points out over here, both in terms of the limitation of consciousness, we intuit at this point the need to expand that and to unite with the entire cosmos and with all beings. If only we could do that, then we find that there is a certain limitation that is overcome. This limitation of consciousness, self-limitation of consciousness into ranges, is something which the soul and the individual, human particularly, feels that it needs to completely overcome and feels that it has the resources to do so. And that is where this notion of unifying with a cosmic consciousness comes in. But even there is a certain incompleteness, and that's the point he's making over here, that the urge or aspiration towards a perfect creation, a perfect manifestation, is part of that can drive part of that intuition and perception. And that includes not only a removal of the experience of suffering at the individual level, but a removal of the possibility of suffering from the cosmic conditions itself. And that's why it's, and that has been also approached in a variety of ways. But that aspiration is what is affirmed, for example, in the idea of the Bodhisattva in Mahayana Buddhism, where the Buddha, the Bodhisattva at the gates of Nirvana refuses to kind of pass through until all individuals are liberated. Now, in Sri Aurobindo's case, he is turning that aspiration in a slightly different direction. It is sort of like, you know, the old puzzle about whether to keep our feet clean, we need to carpet the whole world, or whether we need to put shoes on each person. You know, to look for each individual in the world to become liberated, or to create conditions in the cosmos which will ultimately make it perfect. Sri Aurobindo's solution is to introduce a new form of consciousness in, at the cosmic level, which will, you know, sort of gradually change the conditions, and at the same time, I mean, change the aspiration of the individual so that there is a cosmic, you know, evolution into another status of being for the entire cosmos. So that is the value. And the other point he's making over here is regarding relativity. And this is the, you know, peculiar characteristic of the what we call the evolving ignorance, the cosmos in which we find ourselves, because it's based on this idea, the real idea of the sacrifice of the Purusha, of the Purusha that has denied its conditions of self-existence so as to become its opposite. And it has done so because only then is measure possible. Measure is only possible if you lose, and then you also create not only a zero of loss, but an inverse reality of negatives, so that there is a constant inner struggle through which one can measure the positive, gains that intervene between the loss and the self and the finding. And from that point of view, there is a different kind of joy or delight seeded into that type of universe. That is the delight of the measuring out of the power of the divine. How is it that we can get the true measure of the divine power? Ultimately, it boils down to a question of the evolution of power. And from that point of view, every one of these shortcomings is something that the soul in the universe is pitted against to measure its divine power. Certain other things also, I think, you know, I mean, particularly I'm thinking about partly also about Joanna's question. I think some of the things in the reading of Sri Aurobindo, you know, it's also the relativity of the reception of this, because our own cultural sort of ontologies impact our reading. So that, you know, where he's coming from, not only his consciousness as a yogi, but his cultural consciousness also is something which has certain assumptions in it, which may not be shared by the person who's reading it. So, you know, it's seen as something that is obviously, it's obviation, is missing. It's some obvious things that are part of the background or assumption of what's being given. For example, the idea of reincarnation, which he takes up full fledged later in this book itself, is an assumption which is, I mean, not merely a mental assumption or a cultural assumption that has been received, but also an assumption, philosophical assumption, and a yogic assumption, which has been experienced by a variety of, I mean, by himself, presumably, but also by a variety of beings, a whole archive of beings, you may say, which include this notion of having had lives, you know, including non-living lives and, you know, various kinds of living lives prior to the human, which are all contained in us, as it were. So that evolution is also part of this development of the power of the soul, that the soul has lived those lives and has pushed against those boundaries and has evolved not only in itself but also co-evolved with the structures of nature, pushing them to house it in more adequate forms in which it can evolve greater powers. That evolution is also part of the assumption of this paragraph.
That expands the individual's direct experience.
Ekav, would you like to read next?
This, then, is the law of the manifestation, the reason of the imperfection here. True, it is a law of manifestation only, and even a law special to this movement in which we live. And we may say that it need not have been. If there were no movement of manifestation, or not this movement, but the manifestation and the movement being given, the law is necessary. It is not enough simply to say that the law and all its circumstances are an unreality created by the mental consciousness. non-existent in God, and to be indifferent to these dualities or to get out of the manifestation into God's pure being is the only wisdom. It is true, they are creations of mind consciousness, but mind is only secondarily responsible. In a deeper reality, they are, as we have seen already, creations of the divine consciousness projecting mind away from its all knowledge so as to realize these opposite or contrary values of its all power, all knowledge, all delight, all being and unity. Obviously, this action and these fruits of the divine consciousness can be called by us unreal in the sense of not being the eternal and fundamental truth of being, or can be taxed with falsehood because they contradict what is originally and eventually the truth of being. But all the same, they have their persistent reality and importance in our present phase of the manifestation. Nor can they be a mere mistake of the divine consciousness without any meaning in the divine wisdom, without any purpose of the divine joy, power and knowledge to justify their existence. Justification there must be, even if it reposes for us upon a mystery which may confront us, so long as we live in a surface experience as an insoluble riddle.
So here again we find that Sri Aurobindo is affirming the necessity for meaning. Here is it's again something quite in some ways a modern and uncharacteristic of a lot of the philosophies that have, or theologies particularly, that have try to affirm the existence of the divine, but have justified the cosmic conditions in terms of something that is permanent, and the human condition as just a kind of a happenstance that one doesn't need to try to find any meaning for. This search for meaning, is a kind of one of the primary drives of the human, that we live in a meaningful universe, that we can sort of reduce our understanding of a philosophical understanding to a single idea, and that he's affirming that. So that is a certain kind of demand on life that he is saying that has legitimacy, that we can, the kind of people that say that it's not necessary to look for meaning, they're not fully grappling with the totality of what has emerged in the human, though it may even be something that is conditioned by rationality, that it is coming, that it is emerging in the rational. But he's claiming that that's so because the rational is only embodying properties that are supra-rational. That the search for meaning is coming because there is an idea with a capital I, that rationality intuits, but whose origin is supra-rational. as he starts that paragraph, he talks about this question about why it should be. That could it not have been otherwise? Why this kind of a cosmos? And then he gives an answer to it, which is an existential answer. In other words, it exists, and hence it must have been. You know, there must be a reason to it. This is the kind of answer that he's giving to it. We have to first accept whatever exists. It isn't that it could have existed, but it need not have existed, etc. And the mother at one place says that, you know, all those viewpoints are correct. From a certain viewpoint, we can say that the existence of this kind of a cosmos is an accident only. And that's fine. I mean, that is, you know, we may look upon all the various possibilities that could exist and say that if we can even posit a certain possibility, it exists. That is part of the infinity of the divine. Anything that can be posited or thought of already exists as part of its all existence. And if it exists, then the question is, there is an experience connected with that existence. And whose experience is it? And if it is the experience of a certain kind of limited being, that experiences that is it as something undivine, as it is in this case, then how does it respond to it? What kind of response is possible to it? And so here, this is the validation or justification of the fact that there must be another poise that we are called upon, but not just a poise which leaves conditions over here as they are, but a poise that is only fulfilled if it can overcome the conditions and remove the veil, not only for itself, but for the cosmos itself. He takes this question about this imperfect condition being the creation of the mind. And as he says, it is true, they are creations of mind consciousness, but mind is only secondarily responsible. In a deeper reality, they are, as we have seen already, creations of the divine consciousness, projecting mind away from its all knowledge so as to realize these opposites or contrary values of its all power, all knowledge, all delight, all being and unity. So this mind consciousness, so this, certain philosophies see it as purely a problem of the human mind. It's as if we've created this experience of suffering and of the undivine due to some human problem, the whole issue of the eating of the fruit of good and evil, of a human hubris, or of the Titan stealing fire from God, etc. It's putting the responsibility somehow at the level of something wrong done by some human being. And philosophically, we may say it is the possession of the mind, the fact that we have mind, which gives us certain valuations. We tend to value everything in terms of good and bad, divine and undivine, happiness and suffering, etc. We look at things in terms of these positive and negative valuations due to the mind. But what he's pointing out is that this mind is not something that we created. We inherited it. And we didn't inherit it because of some accident. We inherited it because of a choice in the divine consciousness. And this mind with a capital M, which is the ontology of a mental existence that we experience not that we create, is something that has been particularly designated for giving these kinds of values. And so it is really as a creation of the divine consciousness, which, as he says, has projected mind away from its all knowledge so as to realize these opposite or contrary values, that has given us this experience. And it is only in being able to find the right conditions of consciousness through which this experience can be turned, that we can not only eradicate our own experience, but create a condition in which we create other types of experiences that don't have these values given to that we experience. So that is the whole idea about the human endeavor, that our perception conditions our aspirations, and our aspirations allow us to overcome our conditions. That is the meaning of this situation, as he points out. And it's not a meaning that starts at the human. It's the evolutionary drive which is seeded into the creation at every level of consciousness, in every instance that experiences in its own consciousness. From that point of view, his view is panpsychist, in the sense that everything down to the smallest molecule or particle is actually a container or a is a consciousness, and a level of consciousness that is experiencing under its own conditions this cosmos, and that has behind it the totality of consciousness that may be available to it only to a certain degree, depending on what has emerged in its nature. So in that sense, it is, you know, kind of this way of looking at things is similar to the ideas of people like Leibniz, who are talking of folds in the creation. But the totality of consciousness present in every instance, only like the whole universe is present in each entity, but only the light that is thrown upon the universe illuminates only part of it. And that is the light that is growing in its evolution to illuminate more and more and come to more adequacy of this self-illumination of the universe.
Ramon, would you like to read next?
Thank you. But if accepting this side of nature, we say that all things are fixed in their statutory and stationary law of being, and man too must be fixed in his imperfections, his ignorance, and sin and weakness and vileness and suffering, our life loses its true significance. man's perpetual attempt to arise out of the darkness and insufficiency of his nature can then have no issue in the world itself, in life itself. Its one issue, if there is any, must be by an escape out of life, out of the world, out of his human existence, and therefore out of its eternally unsatisfactory law of imperfect being, either into a heaven of the gods or of God, or into the pure ineffability of the absolute. If so, man can never really deliver out of the ignorance and falsehood the truth and knowledge, out of the evil and ugliness, the good and beauty, out of the weakness and vileness, the power and glory, out of the grief and suffering, the joy and delight, which are contained in the spirit behind them, and of which these contradictions are the first adverse and contrary conditions of emergence. All he can do is to cut the imperfections away from him and overpass to their balancing opposites, imperfect also, leave with the ignorance the human knowledge, with the evil the human good, with the weakness the human strength and power, with the strife and suffering the human love and joy. For these are, in our present nature, inseparably entwined together, look like conjoint dualities, negative pole and positive pole of the same unreality. And since they cannot be elevated and transformed, they must be both abandoned. Humanity cannot be fulfilled in divinity. It must cease, be left behind, and rejected. Whether the result will be an individual enjoyment of the absolute divine nature, or of the divine presence, or a nirvana in the featureless absolute, is a point on which religions and philosophies differ. But in either case, human existence on earth must be taken as condemned to eternal imperfection by the very law of its being. It is perpetually and unchangingly an undivine manifestation in the divine existence. The soul, by taking on manhood, perhaps by the very fact of birth itself, has fallen from the divine, has committed an original sin or error, which it must be man's spiritual aim, as soon as he is enlightened, thoroughly to cancel, unflinchingly to eliminate.
So here, this is one of those typical paragraphs where Sri Aurobindo drives home a point which is sort of like playing, where he plays the devil's advocate, as it were. These are the kinds of paragraphs which lots of people taking out of context can even read as the very contrary of what he's saying. His argument is against all the schools that have affirmed the condition of the cosmos as being something unchanging and permanent, as well as the condition of the human as something unchanging and permanent. The whole cosmos and all its undivine elements as something that is the very condition of its existence. And then, as I said, there may be most of these philosophies don't believe that there is any need to give meaning, to find meaning in this condition. particularly though he ends the paragraph by making a reference to the Christian idea of the fall of some kind of a human error, original human error. Most of the paragraph is really aimed at the Mayavadin schools, not just actually the Mayavadin schools, the whole history of Indian spirituality, which there are a few points in the history of Indian spirituality where Sri Aurobindo differs from the mainstream view, and this is one of them. That is that the condition that has been called avidya, or ignorance with a capital I, is taken by almost the entire history of Indian spirituality to be a permanent condition. That this is a kind of an ontological decision that nothing can change. It's a divine decision. And it is yet not the truth of the divine. It is a veiled condition. And the only way in which we can deal with it is either to completely erase ourselves from it into a nirvana, or to transcend it into the union with a supracosmic infinite, which is the idea of moksha of the Advaitins and laya of the Tantrics, that is dissolution into an infinite consciousness. Or it can be the rise to a supraphysical plane where everything is permanently perfect, as in the Western Pure Land of the Buddhists or of the Vaikuntha of the Vaishnavs, where one perpetually experiences the bliss of a perfect manifestation. So in all these cases, the cosmos is left behind. And as he's saying over there, that not only thereby do we cut the problem of suffering and evil here, but we completely devalue whatever we have gained in terms of human knowledge, human power, and human delight. So that entire sum of, and then if we really look at it from the psychic point of view, again, it's important to see that it is not restricted to the human, but it is the whole cosmic knowledge, the archive of cosmic knowledge that exists within us, locked up within us, and of cosmic power and of cosmic delight, which exists in a conjoint state with their opposites, is also completely denied. It's, as they say, cutting the Gordian knot, which is something Alexander is supposed to have done. But it is exactly cutting the knot that is not permitted. It has to be the unraveling of the knot and the reorganization of its constitution that we are called to do. That is the transformation that is necessary. And so we find that Sri Aurobindo is drawing attention to these ways of looking at things as somehow not validating the primary aspiration within the human. It's interesting that, you know, of course, it's the modern Western tradition of philosophy that has been concerned with creating better conditions in our cosmic existence based on whatever we have. And the philosopher Gilles Deleuze, for example, who draws on Leibniz, thinks about all forms of consciousness as engaging with the world through these through the idea of these folds. And so a fold, we may say that the human being lives within a fold, the human fold. And the fold is a range of consciousness that makes us what we are, our human experience of the cosmos. We can say the human ontology of the cosmos. And each one of these kinds of experiences is something that is one side of the fold. It's like the individual is one side of the fold and the cosmos is the other side of the fold. The individual is an individuation of the cosmos. The human fold lives as a human instance in each individual. Now, that kind of relationship is something which allows each human to actually transform the whole cosmos by transforming themselves. That is the potential within it. And that is why the mastery of the fold becomes the meaning of the aspiration of each of the creatures. It's involved in that process. And at a certain point, it may develop structures that allow it greater mastery and pass it on to another fold, as it were. And its problems become new problems. Now, in this way of looking at things, he posits the idea of the superfold. And the idea of the superfold is related to human capacities. It's almost like, in a certain way, the idea of the Superman. In fact, he uses the notion of the Superman, which he is taking from Nietzsche, but which maps very nicely into the notion of a Superman and a supramental world, being two sides of a new fold towards which we are rising, one may say, in our aspiration. So we find that that kind of engagement with the cosmos that is posited there, he takes up as an aside the kind of solutions that have been developed through the spiritual systems of the East, and he finds an insufficiency there which he calls the unfold. And this is exactly what Sri Aurobindo is talking about. The unfold is something which does not engage with the folded nature of the man-cosmos equation, but completely unfolds it to get out of it. So it is really the unfold that has been the history of most of these theological systems that haven't been able to grapple with the conditions of the avidya. On the other hand, you have the whole tradition of atheism, which, having denied God, turns its shoulder to the wheel of human perfection. But the problem there is that it limits the human fold and cannot exceed its boundaries because it doesn't accept what is within it as the totality of the consciousness that is at work in self-limiting its own conditions. So this is the point where the two are both necessary. The human aspiration has to see itself as voicing the aspiration of the cosmos to arrive at its own sense of power in perfection.
Devashish, there seems to be some relationship of maybe the concept of folds to possibly ideas in new physics. Maybe Keiko might be able to say something. But there seems to be this packaging or two sides of the fold that seem to have some relationship to quantum or relativity?
I wouldn't be able to comment on that. I'm not so familiar with how that would so if somebody else would like to comment, that's fine. But I'm not aware of that kind of idea.
No comment from me either.
It would be interesting, of course, to be able to philosophize conditions of science or of modern physics in terms of the fold, but I don't know. I wouldn't venture into that field at this point, and I don't know if anybody has done it.
Also requires equally deep, experience of both, right?
Yeah. At a philosophical level, it is possible to engage with these and create ideas, conceptions, which make sense of, metaphysics of modern physics is possible, and there are people who've attempted it. And I think more of that is necessary.
On the other hand, I'm remembering a quote from Aurobindo. I think the quote starts something like, you must want something with your will, with your whole will and chase it. And, for instance, I do not try to be a general or a scientist. I don't know if you're aware of that quote. I think it comes in some letters or in one letter.
Yeah, I guess what he's saying is that what we were discussing earlier, that, your aspiration takes, every individual's aspiration takes a certain form. And, it's also related to the idea of Swabhava and Swadharma. And you have to pursue that with your total attention. And in that process, there is a certain growth that takes place. And I think that's what he's kind of referring to there.
Yeah. Thank you, Larissa.
What this kind of gets me thinking about some, what I guess they think of as scientific fables in a certain way, and some of it has been proved and it's still pretty cutting edge, which is about the Dirac Sea. As it relates to ideas that are quite old from ancient Greece about the Akashic records, there's resonance in different certain areas each individual has resonance with certain parts of the entire Akashic record and certain parts of the Dirac Sea, not at all. So maybe the difference. Sorry about the words. The idea of folds could be where the resonance is limited. I don't know. That's an idea.
Yeah, undoubtedly. By the way, I didn't catch that word, Joanna. You said something with the word deroxy or something. What was it?
Deroxy.
Can you spell that for us?
D-I-R-A-C.
I see.
And it's the vibrations that actually occur in vacuum, where we used to think that vacuum was empty. there's actually a whole vibration here. It's all the dinafsi.
I see. I see. Interesting. So, yeah, you know, from the kind of model that Sri Aurobindo is talking about, I think the conceptions like that of the fold are very useful because, see, one of the things that has happened up until, you know, late 20th century is an era of specialization in which we have looked at, say, if we are going to talk about the human, we just talk about the human. If we're going to talk about society, we just talk about society. If we're going to talk about biology, we talk about the whole world of living things. So what happens is that there is a taking of things in isolation. While it's important to think everything at the same time, and that kind of integral thought or movement towards an integral thought requires new conceptions and new languages, a language that can actually think the human and his environment at the same time. See, so this is why these type of conceptions are important as we move forward into a new evolutionary phase, as it were, collectively. So I think from that point of view, you find that this notion of swabhava and swadharma as illuminating a certain part of this totality, as it were, is a kind of a notion of the, you know, the kind of spark soul, that that there is a certain qualitative specificity to each movement of evolution, each instance of evolution, and that specificity is also moving towards universality, but it's moving in a specific way towards universality. I think that is the importance. I mean, it isn't that it has an affinity to only part of the totality, but it's an affinity that grows according to its own, you know, combination of qualities towards fullness. That's the idea that he's giving.
If I may say something here, picture came to me that if we think of a pendulum, simple pendulum, where it is attached from a point, on top, and suppose, it's a ball or something that is hanging, and it is going from left to right, and like back to left, and etc. So basically, it is constantly moving, because it is a simple pendulum. I mean, it will never stop. So, I think it's looking at this movement. It can be done in two ways. By sitting in that ball, in that pendulum, and sitting at the top where the string is attached. So if we see the movement by sitting at the pendulum, it is eternally dual, meaning it has eternal dualism. And if it can be experienced from the point it is the string is attached, then it is quite different. So I think whenever he is describing in terms of dualities and things like that, it is a description or an experience which is at par with that pendulum, which is mental property, because that's the mind doesn't know that point. I mean, the point or top point where the string is attached, it can only experience the pendulum, the ball.
Yeah, indeed. I think that is a nice metaphor. And, it certainly captures that idea of the fact that, as he says, it is a mind problem. The mind itself has been given that kind of orientation or that position by pushing it away. Like he says, it's the divine consciousness has delegated a part of its own operation in a certain way by restricting its abilities. That is the overmind Maya, you may say, that has done that.
I wanted to mention that you want to get more information about the DRFC and the relationship to the Akashic Record. It's Irvin Laszlo, L-A-S-C-L-O.
Joanna, I can barely hear you. I did hear what you said. You talked about Irvin Laszlo, but you're fading out. Maybe.
Sure. So his first name is Irvin, E-R-V-I-N, and his last name is L-A-S-Z-L-O.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, I know last year there was a conference which I attended at Yale.
Should we stop here and plan to continue 2 weeks from now?
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you, Devashista. Thank you, everybody. For the reference.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.